Every so often, I get a call from an individual with 8 or more years of full-time experience, work experience. This individual feels a need for graduate business education to advance his career, and I'm going to use the male in this case just for convenience. And this person wants to move into senior management, but he doesn't really want a full-time 2-year program. Is concerned about his ability to get accepted to the traditional full-time program and really isn't sure where to turn. He's not really interested in the part-time EMBA. He wants an immersive experience. And assuming that the caller really is an impressive individual, I'll suggest several options, and the Stanford's MSX program is almost always on that list. The most common response to my recommendation is, I didn't know about this program. Let me check it out. Today's podcast will be about this excellent option for experienced leaders and hopefully an attempt to make it better known out there. But before we meet our guest, who is director of Stanford's MSX, I want to introduce a few resources at Accepted for more experienced applicants to EMBA programs, the better known part-time option for experienced MBA wannabes. The first one is ACE the EMBA, which provides expert advice for the rising executives applying to top executive MBA programs. And the second one is Top Executive MBA Program Essay Questions, How to Answer Them Right. Now that I've introduced these two free downloadable reports, and they will be linked to from the show notes, I'm really excited, more excited about our guest, actually, than the two reports. I'm really excited to introduce the director of Stanford's MSX program for experienced leaders, Mike Hochleitner. Mike attended UC Santa Cruz, worked, and then did a stint in the Peace Corps. He earned his MBA from Stanford GSB in 1999. Since graduating from GSB, he has worked at the American Leadership Forum, and in 2007, he returned to Stanford GSB, where he was the executive director for the Center of Leadership Development and Research, becoming director of Stanford MSX in 2012. Mike, I'm so pleased to have you on the show. Thank you for coming.
Well, thanks a lot, Linda. It's great to be here.
Good. Can you first, just to start off, can you tell us what is Stanford's MSX program and whom is it for?
The Stanford MSX program, the long form name is the Stanford Masters of Science and Management for Experienced Leaders, is a 1-year full-time program, a residential program for people with, as you said, at least 8 years of work experience. And on average, our students have about 12 years of work experience when they come into the program. It's an accelerated program in general management, very similar to our MBA program, but really targeted at people who already have quite a bit of experience, perhaps don't need to take 2 full years off to get the business education and managerial education that they need, and in many cases don't want to take, can't afford necessarily to take 2 full years off of their career. But at the same time, it represents an alternative to the part-time programs that have become more popular over the years, the executive MBA programs, which, you know, many of our students, people that express interest in the program, say essentially that, you know, I'm worried that a program like that, I'm not going to get the same value. I'm also probably not going to be able to do my job effectively while I'm trying to go to school, while I'm trying to balance my life. And I'm certainly not going to enjoy it as much. So it can be a lot of stress to try to balance all of those things at the same time. And so having a program that's 1 year and actually gives you access to a global cohort of students with a lot of experience is a fairly unique value proposition. It's not one of the common formats out there, and so I think it is a uphill battle to have people understand what the program is, because people hear MBA and they automatically assume it's in most cases, a 2-year full-time program, or they hear EMBA and assume it's a part-time program.
Right.
This is a sort of a unique animal, if you will.
Yeah, but it serves a distinctive niche. And
right, for the audience that it serves, I think it's one of the best things that you can find out there. There's a few other programs like it, but mm-hmm. It's something that Stanford developed this back in the 1950s at a time when corporate managers in the U.S. primarily, there weren't as many options available to them to go back to school. And the format that it took initially was we actually made it available to our first-year PhD students at Stanford.
Uh-huh.
So they would undergo the program alongside a group of corporate managers who were sponsored by their companies. And the idea was that you would get the best of academia and some of the rigorous thinking that the PhDs engaged in would rub off on the corporate managers, and the best of sort of the practical managerial mindset, and some of that practical experience would rub off on the PhDs who are going to go on to be the future teachers of business. And so you had this collaboration that was unique to Stanford that slowly evolved over the years and has become one of only two master's degree that Stanford offers in the business school.
Right. Now, you mentioned that the program officially started, I think, in the 50s, and it wasn't a degree program, then it evolved into the Masters in Management program. How has the program evolved? And obviously, being at Stanford in Palo Alto, you're kind of at the heart of this entrepreneurial, innovative ecosystem and culture. How has the program evolved in response to the increasing emphasis in management education on innovation and entrepreneurship, especially given the location?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the legacy of this program is, was first started with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And Alfred P. Sloan, you may know, was a CEO and chairman of General Motors back in the 50s. And at the time, he was really considered at the forefront of thinkers in management education. And so, he really helped to develop this program, as well as a similar program at MIT and London Business School that were each known as Sloan Fellows programs back at that time. Over the years, the connection to Alfred Sloan is really diminished. And, we are more focused, I think, on the field of entrepreneurship and innovation that you find so active in the region here in Silicon Valley. And so the school has evolved quite a bit. This program, for some period of time, I'd say lagged behind that because it was entirely for people that were sponsored by organizations, which meant they tend to be sponsored by very large organizations, global organizations. And it was only in 2001 that we opened up the program to people that were not sponsored by an organization, which allowed people that were more interested in entrepreneurial opportunities or career changes to join in the program. And so I think at that point, in many ways, the program caught up with the school just in mirroring the profile of students that we see within our MBA program. And it's really only in the last few years, in 2011 and 2012, we underwent a fairly deep strategic review of the program and actually tried to undergo a number of changes that would really look ahead at where we think management education is headed and make sure that this program is not only in alignment with what the Stanford Graduate School of Business is trying to do, but in some ways is at the leading edge of what we're trying to do. And, giving people an opportunity to come to the GSB from all over the world, immerse themselves in both the management fundamentals that we consider to be core to what we teach at the business school, as well as the broader university. And our students have access to, students and courses and programs across the university, including at the School of Engineering and our, what we refer to here as the D School, mm-hmm. the Hasso Plattner Institute for Design, mixed with students from law and medicine and education and all these different backgrounds. And really, also being based in Silicon Valley, you have access to the capital that's here and Sand Hill Road. And there's a very entrepreneurial culture that I've found is developed around this program because people at this stage of their career don't have a lot of opportunities to immerse themselves in this type of an environment. It's almost like an incubator of sorts where they have access to ideas, they have access to both young and very experienced entrepreneurs. And they're sort of immersed in an environment where they're challenged to think outside the box and test new ideas and try a lot of things that they may be able to fail quickly on in a low-risk environment so that by the time they're ready to graduate, they have a good idea of what they want to do next. And many of them, over the last year, we've seen some of the highest proportions of our students go into entrepreneurial ventures right out of school. I'd say in some ways it's almost a bit of a cautionary thing. I don't know that we're trying to encourage it necessarily, but it's sort of the sign of the times today.
Right, for sure. So would you say that the name change in 2013 from the Sloan Fellows Masters in Management to the Stanford Masters of Science in Management for Experienced Leaders, was that more a reaction to something that had already taken place? In other words, less dependence upon the Sloan name and the Sloan funding? Or was it a more forward-looking change? I mean, what did that change signify?
Well, it signified two things. One is you can sort of think of it as maybe a carrot and a stick. We think it is forward-looking. We wanted something that was very strongly identified with Stanford. It is a unique program, so in some ways we wanted to have a unique name. We wanted to grab people's attention since it doesn't benefit from the fact that tens of billions of dollars are spent every year marketing MBA programs and more traditional programs, and so people are aware of what those programs are, who they're for, whereas this doesn't show up in a lot of the rankings because it's not part of the categories that the media tends to cover. And so we wanted something that on its own would draw attention to it and also really signify what makes it unique is really that experience component. And so that's why we use the X in the MSX abbreviation.
Right.
The other side of it is it was a reaction to, I think, things that have happened in the past. One is the Sloan name, while it was long associated with Alfred Sloan, who was really considered a forward-thinking executive of his day, Alfred Sloan is not so well-known today. What is well-known is the MIT Sloan School of Management.
Got it.
And MIT is a great school. I have a lot of respect for MIT and for the program there, but we really wanted to make sure that this program was identified as a Stanford program. From time to time, we would have people that were confused about the connection between Stanford and MIT. And apart from the name, there really is no connection. We run two completely separate programs. And so we were excited to change the name as we were going through a number of changes in the program. And I can speak to a little bit of that. We increased the size of the cohort, so we're able to increase the network that people get as they go through the program. We extended the length of the year from 10 months to 11 months, which doesn't seem like a long extension, but it does actually give us the ability to offer a four-quarter program instead of a three-quarter program, means that people have access to a lot more electives as they go through the program and access to the rest of the university in a way that they never had prior to that. So now most of our students do take classes outside of the business school, and it gives them a whole range of different options, especially for people that come from a technical background. About half of our students actually have advanced degrees before they come to Stanford.
Really?
And so if you have, let's say, a degree in science or engineering or law or medicine, the option to take some classes, say, at the medical school or the law school or the School of Engineering, that not only you already get a strong grounding in business education and general management, but the ability to then add to that some classes that really keep you at the forefront of your field in whichever area you've already specialized in. Where else but Stanford do you have access to such a broad range of top-notch schools and programs? And so we wanted to make sure that we were really leveraging that and giving our students the opportunity to take full advantage of that.
Now, I noticed that students are advised to budget $5,000 for two study trips to Portland, Seattle, and to Washington, D.C., New York. That sounds great. Sounds like a lot of fun. But what is the purpose of these trips, and do they sometimes take trips outside the U.S.?
Yeah, the $5,000 figure is actually a little bit outdated. We used to require an international trip as part of the program. And so the $5,000 actually included a budget for that.
Yeah, it was kind of surprised for two domestic trips. It was like, huh?
We're staying in some really nice places.
Yeah. Food's fantastic.
So it's actually quite a bit less. The only trip that is required is the New York, Washington, D.C. trip. And we take that trip at the end of the summer quarter. The program begins in July, so we do an 8-week summer quarter. And then at the end of that summer quarter, we make the trip to New York and Washington, D.C. The theme is resilience in leaders, organizations, and economies. Mm-hmm. And it really, while still close to the beginning of the year, it helps to synthesize many of the topics that we study during that summer quarter, such as economics, strategy, both in markets and beyond markets, ethics, finance, and such topics, and as well as some leadership development that we start within the summer quarter, where people are really looking at their own leadership strengths and leadership style that they want to develop. And over the course of a week, we meet with a variety of senior level officials, and you know, from year to year it varies, but we've had the opportunity to meet with the Federal Reserve Chair, with the heads of the New York Stock Exchange, mm-hmm. companies like Time Warner or AIG or BlackRock, you know, people that are running large entities, both in government and in a variety of different industries. Many of whom not only are running their own organizations, but are actually running an organization that's pretty important to the economic, political, and governance system that business leaders rely upon. So it's a fairly unique opportunity to hear firsthand in a concentrated way from people that are thinking about public policy, shaping public policy, as well as running some of the institutions that are underpin the economy that we're all a part of. So that's, you know, that's one trip. And then in the spring, we go to Seattle, and this is an optional trip, but most of our fellows do participate in it. And the focus of the Seattle trip is on marketing and operations, which are topics that are taught in the core curriculum in winter and spring. And so it gives people an opportunity. We visit companies like Boeing and Starbucks and Packard, and looks like Amazon.
I was in Microsoft. No.
We visited Microsoft in the past. Yeah. So there's a lot of companies up in that area that are remarkable, both in terms of their global marketing as well as operations. We've had the opportunity to tour the plants at Boeing, which is the largest building in the world in terms of its physical footprint, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine there's a lot of great stuff that you can see on the ground and actually as you're walking the shop floor with the plant managers, and you get a sense that really reinforces what we're trying to teach in the classroom. In addition to that, while we don't require an international study trip, we started this year on a pilot basis, but we've seen enough success that we're going to continue and expand this. The school runs more than 20 international study trips a year in the context of the MBA program. So for the MBA, the two-year MBA program, we actually require what we call a global education requirement. And most students fulfill that requirement by going on an international study trip. And the study trips are proposed and led by second-year MBA students. And this year we had 21 trips that went to just, you know, every continent with the exception of Antarctica. Actually, last year they did have a trip that went to Antarctica.
Really? Wow.
So they're varied. They all get great reviews. The students put a lot of work into making sure that they're meeting with some very senior level people. And regardless of what your personal interest may be, there's going to be several trips that would be fascinating to anybody. If you're interested in international development work, if you're interested in high finance, if you're interested in fast-growing developing economies or more mature economies, there's a variety of different options there. And so this year we had the option for our students to go on those trips. We weren't able to meet all of the demand, but my hope is that starting next year we'll be able to meet all the demand that our students have in terms of
and these trips.
International trip.
I mean, is there a paper that's due after them? Are you meeting with business leaders on the scene, or does this just depend upon where you're going?
Well, it depends a little bit on where you're going, but all the trips have pre-trip study sessions, so there are several requirements. The groups meet together before the trip goes to do some preliminary work and make sure that they're prepared for the trip in terms of both expectations as well as having been briefed on kind of the key issues that they'll be looking at. And then they do have to submit reflection and evaluation reports after they go on the trip, documenting essentially what some of the key takeaways have been, as well as, you know, what they learned, what they thought could have been better. So, I mean, the school is constantly trying to make sure that we're learning from the process of running these trips, and every year we want to make the trips a little bit better if we can.
You mentioned before that there's a minimum of 8 years of experience required for the fellows and that the average amount of experience is 12 years. At the same time, you know, you talked about diversity in the classroom. I know two-thirds are from outside the United States and professional background. Is there any common denominator among Stanford MSX fellows?
Mm-hmm. Well, we generally look at three criteria in the admissions process, which are demonstrated leadership accomplishments. So we want to see that people have been fairly aggressive and ambitious about what they're trying to accomplish over the course of their career. And I would say that the 8 years is considered a minimum. We have sort of the letter and the spirit of the rule as far as how we classify someone according to that minimum. But really, our focus is more on quality than quantity. This program's unique in that people coming into the program generally have considerably more managerial experience than in a traditional MBA program. But beyond that, we really want to make sure that people have had an impact on the organizations or the industries in which they've worked. So that's the first criteria. Second is intellectual vitality. And you can expect that there's some very accomplished people out there that really aren't that interested in going back to school. They're not that interested in working in an academic environment. Either they don't like the idea of studying theory, or they may just kind of enjoy what they do and they're happy with what they do. And that's great, but they're probably not the right fit for going to Stanford for a year.
Right.
And the third criteria is what we call clarity of purpose, which is really looking at what's been the trajectory that someone has had to date, and where are they thinking they're going to go over the next 3 to 5 years, and does that trajectory make sense? And partly this is a bit of a screen. Because a one-year program is, and we can talk about this a little bit more in terms mm-hmm. of people's career paths, but, you know, it's probably not realistic for someone in their mid-30s to say, you know, I've been working in this industry, in this geography, in this job function, and, you know, I want to change all of those things, and I expect it all to happen in 1 year.
Uh-huh.
You know, coming out of a program like this, any prospective employer is going to be looking at one's past history and work accomplishments as much, if not more, than the fact that this individual has gone to Stanford for a year. And so we need to understand that someone is really building off of what they've already accomplished in terms of their plans for the future, and that's really what we look for in terms of clarity of purpose. So these are very general bonds in terms of what's similar.
Mm-hmm.
Really, we're looking for putting together a cohort that is incredibly diverse geographically, in terms of industry experience, in terms of personal experience, and that's very much a part of the program. It's not simply admitting a series of very accomplished people, but admitting a cohort that is representative of the global economy and is going to contribute as much to the learning experience as our faculty, as all the different parts of the school would contribute to the learning experience.
Now, in terms of, and you touched on this a little bit, in terms of the curriculum, that the required classes, the structure of the curriculum, obviously it's 1 year, so it's roughly half the length of the full-time MBA. But what are some of the differences between the requirements for the MSX as opposed to the full-time MBA? I mean, Stanford's full-time MBA is known as being very very highly customizable. Is the MSX program more of a program, you know, where it's a little bit more rigid, you know, people go in lockstep, or you know, could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I think it, yes and no.
Okay.
Our core curriculum is, I would say, less flexible than the MBA core curriculum, but partly because it's shorter. The number of required units within the core curriculum, just to use an example, there's many courses where our MBA students would be required to take a 4-unit class, and in our students' case, they take a 2-unit class. So they essentially compress some of the content and don't spend as much time on things that someone who's been working in management would most likely know, some of the tacit knowledge we expect people to gather as they go through their career, and pull that out of the core curriculum, and then give people the flexibility to focus on their electives. So the core curriculum is, in one sense, more flexible because there's less of it. It's less flexible in the sense that you know, we don't offer, I mean, we have one class, the accounting class, where people can get a waiver if they pass an exemption exam. Whereas in the MBA program, there's a few different classes where there's, you know, advanced versions and base versions, or you have a choice of, you have to take 2 of these 4 different, you know, optional elective or optional semi-required classes, let's call them.
Right.
And so there's less flexibility in that respect. And we also, because it's a 1-year program, we don't, we haven't developed a series of joint or dual degrees the way that we have with the MBA program. And that's largely just a function of time. You know, when you have a 2-year program and you're trying to develop a joint or dual degree with another school that has a 1 or 2-year program, you can usually compress things a little bit to save the student a little bit of time. But if you're talking about 2 1-year programs, it's a lot more difficult to compress things.
So I would also assume that there's less demand in your market for a dual degree program. You mentioned that many of your fellows already have an advanced degree, and they're just further along in their lives.
Exactly. There's less than 20% of our MBA students come into the program with having already received a master's or PhD. Whereas it's 47% for our students. So
wow, that's a big difference.
Actually, more of our students graduate from Stanford with they've gotten 2 degrees by the time they graduate from our program than graduate from the MBA program with 2 degrees, even though about 1 in 6 of our MBA students are getting a dual degree here Stanford or a joint degree. So I think that is largely right. We do occasionally see students who do this program and then they stay on and apply to another master's program at Stanford, although that's fairly rare.
Right. Now, another question, and this again goes back to the answer you gave to my common denominator question, where you indicated that, you know, radical career change is not a realistic goal or not does not show true clarity of purpose, realistic clarity of purpose for a 1-year program. But nobody's doing this program to go back and do the exact same thing they did before. So what, they're all on some level career changes. Maybe they want to move out of a more technical role into a more general management role. They want to move from middle management into senior management. What is appropriate kind of career change in your view for a fellow?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I don't expect anybody to come here. Even about a third of our students that come here are sponsored by their employer, and so they are expected in just about every case to go back to work for the employer that they were working for before coming to Stanford. But I think both in terms of the employer's expectations as well as the student's expectations, they're not expecting to go back and play the exact same role and just do their job a little bit better. They're looking to advance their career and their ability to influence the things at their organization. You know, I think that One person who said this well was a guy named Tom Friel, who's a graduate of Stanford and the former CEO of Heidrick & Struggles. And he came, and each year, actually next week, he's coming and giving a talk to our students. But each year he comes, and he sort of gives them advice about how to think about their career development. And he says, look, if you're 25 years old and you're coming to a two-year MBA program, it's basically an opportunity to do a full reset on your career. You've only got 3 or 4 years of work experience, and if you're going to spend 2 years in school, you know, an employer is going to look at those 2 years as probably more relevant than what you've done before going to business school. But if you already have 10 years of work experience and you're coming to a program for 1 year, the fact is that employers and partners and other people that you're going to be working with are really looking at your resume in a more comprehensive way and saying, you know, what is your past experience in this industry or in this geography or in this job function? And at least on one of those dimensions, you're probably best off focusing in an area where you already have some key strengths. Mm-hmm. So we sometimes refer to in sort of the career management area of business school as people trying to do the triple jump. They're trying to go to a new industry. They're trying to change geographies. They're trying to change job functions. And I would classify going from a technical role to more of a general management role as a change in job function. Mm-hmm. And I think most of our students are trying to advance on that dimension, if not any others. Many are trying to also change either industry and or geography. And so I wouldn't say it's unrealistic. It's certainly not impossible, and I've seen some students do significant changes that I would have said at the outset, I don't necessarily recommend doing it, at least if you feel a sense of pressure of wanting to get a job in a short period of time. But we have seen people go from all sorts of industries and all sorts of countries coming into Stanford and leaving here and going into, say, venture capital or private equity or a different industry than they've come from. And in particular, some industries that are known for being very difficult to break into, especially at this stage of one's career. However, the numbers are, we see that it takes people longer. They often have more difficulty when they're trying to make a change across all three of those dimensions as opposed to just one or two. And we really encourage our students to do their homework, get to know the industries that they're interested in, because some changes are much more difficult and challenging than others. And if you really understand the strengths that your past experience gives you, it may be possible to make a change into a very different industry or a different geography if you really can play off of those strengths and know how they relate to the industry or the geography that you're trying to get into. So our students work very closely with our Career Management Center. We've actually undergone a number of changes internally to better serve our students, since we do recognize that the job searches they are undertaking are very different than the job searches that our MBA students are undertaking.
Right.
We used to basically lump them together, and our Career Management Center staff was finding themselves sort of at a loss because they were trying to use the same services and the same approach that they use with our MBA students with students in this program. And one simple metric, the median salary of students when they come into this program is significantly higher than the median salary of our MBA students after they leave Stanford. And so for the types of jobs that our students are typically going after and what the recruitment process is within companies for those types of jobs, we really need to take a different approach. And so we've reorganized our Career Management Center over the last year and a half and provide a very different type of service to the students that are going through this program. It really needs to be a self-led career search, since every student is so unique in many respects, and their job goals are often unique enough that they're kind of an N of one amongst the students that are looking for that particular type of job. But we do have a lot of resources at the school and amongst our alumni and broader network to tap into to help them as they undergo that job search.
And for the, I assume the one third that are sponsored don't have access to the career services, or do they have access? And the two thirds that are not sponsored do have access to career services. Is that correct? Or
Well, everybody has access to career services. Mm-hmm. The career services that are specific to a job search, yes, we don't offer those by default to students that are sponsored. We have an internal process whereby which anybody who is having their tuition paid by a third party, that's typically the case when someone is sponsored by an organization, needs to get authorization from that third party for them to undertake any of the activities that are related to a job search. However, all of our students have access to career coaches and a number of workshops that are really more about how to manage your career over the long term than they are about how to find a specific job. And we really do encourage all of our students, whether they're sponsored or not, to undertake those types of activities, which we consider to be beneficial to the organizations that they'll be working for.
Right. And is there any, I assume that any fellow would have access to whatever career support you provide after they graduate, right? Whether sponsored or not sponsored.
Yeah, we have various alumni career resources through the school, and we don't have any screening mechanism to say, well, sorry, you didn't pay for your
$200
pocket. I mean, if you're an alum of the school, then you have access to the alumni resources.
Right. Now, since 2002, you've been involved in the nurturing and training of leaders for one institution or another. And I know there are libraries and books and seminars and movies and tapes and all kinds of resources talking about leadership. So I'm kind of putting you on the spot here when I'm going to ask you in a few short minutes on a small podcast to answer the question I'm about to ask. But here it is. What are the effective steps, 1 to 3 steps, that young professionals can take to develop leadership qualities in themselves?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a question I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And before coming to Stanford, I was involved in a variety of different organizations focused on leadership development. And I've had the fortune to work with people that are running large organizations, CEOs and high-level executives in major global organizations. I've spent 5 years here at the business school focusing primarily on the leadership development of our MBA students, mostly 25 to 27-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually really enjoyed now working with the population in this program, which is somewhere in between. And what's great about it is these are people that are still close enough to what's happening on the front lines, people in the bottom of the organization, that they have access to that frontline insight. And yet they've advanced far enough that I think they can really grasp some of the struggles and challenges that people at the top of the organization, the C-level executives, are dealing with as well. So they're in this very interesting position where I think in many respects they can have tremendous influence over the success of the organizations that they're with. But I would say across all three populations, I think there's a few things that I found are pretty universal. And, first, and this may come across as a little bit trite because I think it gets said so often, but sometimes things that are really simple are the hardest to implement. The first thing to think about is really know thyself. And this gets attributed to Socrates and other people as well over the centuries, but if you can understand what your passions and your strengths are, as well as what gaps you may have or areas that are really difficult for you to self-motivate around, that is really powerful knowledge to know where you're going to excel and where you're going to work harder, where you're going to be motivated to overcome obstacles and struggle if necessary to achieve outcomes. So first is to really take stock of observe your behaviors, observe how you react under certain circumstances so that you can gain some appreciation for what situations are going to draw upon your best efforts. And second is to place yourself in challenging or stretch roles. Everybody wants to get into the place that is the I don't want to say everybody, but most people want to go into a place that's already working really well. They want to go work for the hot company. They want to go work for the department that seems to have all the resources and is always being complimented. The people that over the long run often end up having the most successful careers, I find, are people that have placed themselves in situations where they know they're going to have to struggle, where they know they're going to face setbacks and challenges. And really, that's where, in many cases, the payoff and impact that you can have as an individual or as a leader is probably more significant than if you're going to work for a place that already is running well and has all the resources that it needs. And then the last thing I would say is take learning seriously. So it's one thing to know something about yourself and to put yourself into challenging roles, but if you're not paying attention to what you're learning along the way, I find that organizations, this is something that trips up organizations and prevents them from repeating success, is that they don't document what's working well, what's not working well, or even what's happening to allow themselves to go back and do what the military might refer to as an after-action review, which is essentially just take a little bit of time to say what happened here, what went well, what didn't go so well, what experiments might we run to see if we can get this done more quickly or more efficiently or better in the future. And just that extra little bit of time to mine the learning, whether it's on a weekly or monthly basis, can make a huge impact over the course of 5 years or 10 years of someone's career, both individually as well as organizationally. So I think those are three things that I try to implement in the teams that I'm working with, but it's certainly something that is part of any leadership curriculum that I develop.
Well, I know that, you know, again, many of the listeners today are either interested in MBA programs or graduate school, and I think if there's any quality that every leading graduate school wants to see, and I'm not talking now about intellectual prowess, I'm talking about character, they want to see leadership. And I think there's a certain member of many, leader of none syndrome out there, and I think that sometimes the applicants themselves have to take a little bit of responsibility for their own leadership development, and that's why I asked the question that I asked, and I really appreciate the response. And since this podcast is devoted to admissions, and this particular show is focused on Stanford's MSX program, what advice would you give to somebody who's interested in becoming an MSX fellow, who is planning to apply for the 2015 cycle, or do you still have any spots left for applicants interested in a 2014 application?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, just some general things to consider is one is, just in terms of timing really quickly, the program begins in July of each year. Mm-hmm. So we take applications. We just received applications at our second round deadline in mid-January.
Right.
But we'll continue to take applications up through April.
Okay.
And we are gradually expanding the program a little bit each year, so I do anticipate we'll have some spaces in the program up until close to that deadline, if not through the end of April. We don't take international applications after February, partly because we have to go through a process of making sure that someone can get visa, immigration clearance, and such. So we're a little bit limited there, but we will continue to take applications until April of 2014. More generally, I would say that people that are considering this program, first, they just need to do their homework and really understand what are their options out there and really understand some of the pros and cons of a one-year program versus a two-year program versus a part-time program. I think this is a great option that many people just aren't aware of because it's not the norm. But there are some pros and cons to it, and I do find that on the edges, in terms of our students that come into the program, there's inevitably some that get through the program and say, gee, I really wish I had an extra quarter or two to continue my studies because, for whatever reason, I'm trying to make a bigger change perhaps than I originally anticipated or something like that. And then there's other people that, they're getting job offers by the time they get here. And so, they're almost itching for opportunities to to not be in school full time. But I think most of the people really have done their homework. They do find that this is really the right fit for them. As I mentioned before, we look at three general criteria: demonstrated leadership accomplishment, intellectual vitality, and clarity of purpose. Right. And I think that if someone is going through the application process, that third criteria, the clarity of purpose, is probably the thing that they have the most influence over. And if anything, the application process can often help with that a little bit, because it really challenges someone to think about what are my goals, how does this relate to where I want to be in 2 or 3 or 5 years, you know, what do I think I already know, and what do I already do well, and what are the things that I'm going to develop through the course of study. These are things that I think we really look for in the application. In many respects, someone's resume and letters of recommendation kind of speak to their demonstrated leadership accomplishment. So I think those are important things to consider, and certainly someone should be thinking about who they want to ask to write them a letter of recommendation. And in terms of intellectual vitality, we ask for transcripts and prior academic work. We sometimes can discern things through the professional experience that someone has. And we do require that applicants take the GMAT exam. And if they are a non-native English speaker, they'll also have to take the TOEFL exam. And so those give us some window into someone's intellect a bit. And obviously, there's limitations to that.
Right.
But really, I think that, you know, where we look to the applicant to articulate, you know, where they've come from, where they see themselves going over the next few years, what their ambitions are. It's really that clarity of purpose and that focus that I think often the weakest part of the application. I mean, we see people that are remarkable in terms of things they've accomplished, and you know, they have test scores that are really great, but sometimes it's just they don't have a clear sense of where they want to go, and that's, you know, it's understandable. Part of the reason people want to go back to school is to expose themselves to some new things and think outside the box. And certainly many people that have been through the program over the years, when I talk to alumni, a lot of what they say is, you know, hey, this program gave me what I was looking for, but it also gave me a lot of stuff that I never expected to get. And so that's okay, but we do want people to come in with a sense of, you know, essentially all else being equal, here's what I'm trying to achieve, here's how I think my past experience is going to contribute to that. Here's what I think Stanford can contribute to help me fill in those gaps. And I think that's something that I strongly encourage anybody who's looking at this program to spend a little bit of time really thinking that through and making sure that their thought process is pretty clear.
Right. Well, I don't think you realize that, but one of my big things in my work with applicants, really any kind of graduate applicant, I think that's one of the big differences between graduate school and undergraduate school, is that your study has to have a clear purpose and has to be a realistic purpose. Otherwise, you can just make a big mistake in terms of committing to a certain amount of time and a tuition expense that isn't going to take you where you want to go, because you basically don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. And that's just not a good idea. But
I'll just say, you know, something that anecdotally I've seen over the last couple of years is that, you know, the summer quarter people come in here, and I call this summer the entrepreneurship quarter, because, you know, some percentage of the class comes to Stanford to really focus on an entrepreneurial venture. Mm-hmm. And they usually have so much enthusiasm and so much energy coming into the program that they often you know, infuse a sense amongst their classmates that entrepreneurship is the thing that you have to do, that everybody coming to Stanford should be looking to start a company. And suddenly, even though maybe 20% of the class came in saying that they were going to do entrepreneurship, I suddenly find that 60% of the class says they're interested in becoming an entrepreneur. And then the fall quarter is what I call the private equity quarter. This is where, you know, all our MBA students come back, and there's a lot of them that are sort of focused on getting into private equity, and then suddenly that seems like that's the thing that everybody needs to do. And so, you know, I'm very determined in the summer to put people through a process, and this includes a 360-degree leadership assessment and a variety of other exercises that we go through, as well as some one-on-one executive coaching that our students get, that focuses on, you know, what are your priorities academically, career-wise, and leadership development-wise. And so by midway or most of the way through the summer, each of our students should have documented essentially a few priorities in each of those areas. And as the year goes on, and there's just endless things that are great at Stanford for people to get exposed to, and
right.
a lot of, you know, distractions, great distractions that can pull people in some directions. And every once in a while, one of those are really serendipitous, and they're really it really does expose someone to a new area that they are excited about, and they do go off and pursue something successful. But more often what happens is someone sees something, it looks really attractive, they spend some time learning more about it because it sounds great, but they realize, like, okay, I know about it, but I'm not going to pursue it. And we want to make sure that essentially all of our students have a metaphorical anchor in terms of what their goals are, what their priorities are coming into the program. And so as they expose themselves to those different opportunities, they don't spend too much time maybe pursuing things that really don't have a long-term strategic interest for them, that they come back and make sure that they are spending adequate time on the things that are really their priorities.
Right, and I think that that's probably what you mean when you talk about clarity of purpose would be just a certain set of priorities in terms of what you want to accomplish professionally and in terms of your, you know, the MSX experience, whatever education you're seeking. There's a big difference between a weather vane that kind of shifts with the wind and one that's mm-hmm. broken and just spins around.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's, I think, a critical difference when you're talking about graduate education, and obviously that's very important to you based on what you've said, that there is this sense of, I know what's important to me, I know what my priorities are, and yeah, if an opportunity comes up, I can based on my priorities, explore that opportunity, I can decide to pursue or not pursue it, but first I have to have that sense of direction, that set of priorities.
Yeah. And our students, they come here, they know they're at a place like Stanford, which is obviously famous for, being the starting place of all sorts of now famous companies. And so they want to breathe in the atmosphere. They want to be a part of the and understand what's behind that engine of innovation. So even, I certainly don't want to undersell that or suggest that anybody who says they're interested in entrepreneurship, even if they're not going to go off and start a company, is in some ways just a weather vane blowing in the wind. I think in most cases people know what they're doing. They want to get exposed. They want to spend some time trying to understand what the what the secret sauce is a little bit, even though ultimately they know they're going to go work for a more established company.
Right.
But hopefully with an entrepreneurial edge to them, some ability to think, sometimes we use the term intrapreneur,
right.
Someone who knows how to start things within an organization, get resources, and essentially grow a micro enterprise within a larger organization.
Right. Look, I think that, again, goes to the intellectual vitality that you're talking about. I think direction doesn't mean rigidity. It doesn't mean that you say, I don't want to know about anything outside of my narrowly defined interests. I do think it means a set of priorities and direction. And I completely agree that it's really important. And it grows in importance as one advances in one's career. Mike, I've really enjoyed learning about the MSX program, but I don't want to abuse your generosity any more than I already have. So I think I'm going to bring the show to a close. I want to thank you very much for joining me here today. Where can a listener learn more about Stanford's MSX program?
Well, certainly probably the best source of information initially is to just go on the website, so anybody can come to the Stanford Graduate School of Business website, /MSX. And it'll go to our page. But it'll be right there on our homepage. And within our site, it'll give hopefully comprehensive information about the program, including some new videos that they provide a little bit of an introduction, as well as all the admissions process. And there's also email addresses there that make it really easy for people to request additional information. We do run a series of informational webinars right now, this late in the application process or admissions timeline. That's the best way to speak one-on-one or speak with us is through the online webinars.
Great. We'll include a link in the show notes at info.accepted.com/41 to both Stanford GSB's MBA program as well as to Stanford's MSX program. And as I said earlier, we'll also link to the EMBA special reports that I mentioned at the beginning of the show from the show's show notes. Again, the URL for the show notes is info.accepted.com/41. Listeners, thank you, too, for joining us today for our 41st episode. It's hard to believe. As always, please share your feedback on iTunes, the blog, or by emailing lynda@accepted.com. And if you're not yet a subscriber, please do so. Please subscribe either through iTunes, Stitcher, or Zoom. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Lynda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.